Genesis 47:13-31, the 43rd talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on November 2, 2003 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at chapter 47 of Genesis. We're getting close to the end here. My plan is to do chapter 47 today. There are a couple of bigger issues that I want to talk about at the end. But I think that there will be time for questions. And then next week, my plan is to finish out Genesis. Where we left off is that Jacob had moved his whole family down into Egypt. They've been reunited with Joseph. But Joseph had insisted that they settle on the outskirts of Egypt in Goshen, just to the east of the delta. And there they began taking care of their own herds as well as working for Pharaoh, taking care of his herds. But that was at the beginning of the famine. It was 2 years into the famine, and the famine, as God had predicted, was to last 7 years. So there are five more years of famine. And what it talks about in this next chapter is what happened in the ensuing 5 years of the famine. If you'll recall, last time, Jacob appeared before Pharaoh. And both when he first appeared before Pharaoh and then as he was departing after meeting with Pharaoh, it says that Jacob blessed Pharaoh. And it's hard to know what to make of that, but as we see in this next section, Pharaoh is greatly blessed by Joseph's activity as his vizier during these years of famine. Chapter 47, we'll start verse 13. Now there was no food in all the land because the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. And Joseph gathered all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the grain which they bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. And when the money was all spent in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, "Give us food, for why should we die in your presence? For our money is gone." Then Joseph said, "Give up your livestock, and I will give you food for your livestock, since your money is gone." So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them food in exchange for the horses, and the flocks, and the herds, and the donkeys. And he fed them with food in exchange for all their livestock that year. And when that year was ended, they came to him the next year and said to him, "We will not hide from my lord that our money is all spent, and the cattle are my lord's. There is nothing left for my lord except our bodies and our lands. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for food, and we and our land will be slaves to Pharaoh. So give us seed that we may live and not die, and that the land may not be desolate." So the famine continues on. People run out of food, so they have to buy food. We saw that happening in the first 2 years of the famine. That process continues until all of their money is spent. So now they can't buy the food anymore. So now they come to Pharaoh, they come to Joseph, and they say to Joseph, "We're out of money. I mean, if we don't get some more food, we're going to die." And Joseph says, "Well, then bring your livestock. I will give you food in exchange for your livestock." Now, on the one hand, I mean, that's beneficial in that if you have livestock, you have something you have to feed. There are additional mouths that have to be fed. And so there's a sense in which the livestock is competing for the food that the family has. So in a sense, they're probably eager to get rid of the livestock. If they can sell that and get food for it, that's probably a good trade. In any case, that's what happens. And interestingly, the first animal that's listed here is horses. Horses don't come into Egypt, as far as we know, until the Hyksos came down into Egypt. So there's another tie here that this is either during the Hyksos or soon after the Hyksos. So they sell all of their animals. And that gets them through another year. But there's still more famine to go. They come back and they say to Joseph, "We have no money, we have no livestock, and we're out of food. Now what?" And it's the people that actually propose. They say, "All we have left is ourselves and our lands. Let us sell that in exchange for food." And so Joseph allows that transaction to take place as well. So now they are sold to Pharaoh. They've sold all of their land, but they're happy because they've been able to survive the famine. Notice that at each time it says that the famine was raging both in Egypt and in Canaan. So you can imagine then, he's kind of hinting, what would have been the fate of Jacob's family had they still been in Canaan. That this problem is still extremely severe even in Canaan. Next section, starting with verse 20. So Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for every Egyptian sold his field, because the famine was severe upon them. Thus the land became Pharaoh's. And as for the people, he removed them to the cities from one end of Egypt's border to the other. Only the land of the priests he did not buy, for the priests had an allotment from Pharaoh, and they lived off the allotment which Pharaoh gave them. Therefore, they did not sell their land. Then Joseph said to the people, "Behold, I have today bought you and your land for Pharaoh. Now here is seed for you, and you may sow the land. And at the harvest, you shall give a fifth to Pharaoh, and four-fifths shall be your own for seed of the field, and for your food, and for those of your households, and as food for your little ones." So they said, "You have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's slaves." And Joseph made it a statute concerning the land of Egypt, valid to this day, that Pharaoh should have the fifth. Only the land of the priests did not become Pharaoh's. The end result of this process is that Pharaoh owns everything. He owns the land. The people are his slaves. He has benefited enormously from this famine. And all of this money has gone into Pharaoh's pocket. The narrator has made it really clear that Joseph has not personally benefited from this, at least not beyond what he should have benefited. There is a phrase in here in verse 21. My translation says, "And as for the people, he removed them to the cities from one end of Egypt's border to the other." Now, that there's another reading in some of the other manuscripts. If this is what Moses intended to say, then apparently, remember, the cities had become the storehouses where the grain was kept, and Pharaoh is buying the land. Apparently, there's a process whereby much of the population is moving from the rural areas into the cities. So if this is the correct reading, that there must be some urbanization that's taking place. At least people are emptying the fields and the countryside. But my suspicion is that this reading is not correct. This is the reading from the Masoretic text, which is considered to be the most reliable of the Hebrew texts. The Septuagint, which is the version, the Greek translation that was made, I think, 300 B.C., it has another reading, and the Samaritan Pentateuch, that is the version of the Hebrew Bible that was retained in Samaria, follows the Septuagint in this reading. And that reading says, "He reduced them to slavery from one end of Egypt's border to the other." And the difference between them is one consonant and two tittles. The difference between an R and a D in Hebrew is one itty-bitty tail. And if you don't see the tail, then it's an R. And if you see the tail, it's a D. So it'd be very easy to confuse them. If you know Hebrew at all and you're losing your vision like me, then you can hardly tell the difference between an R and a D. Hebrew in general was not written for people with bad eyesight. They have a lot of letters that are easily confused. I suspect that this is the correct reading, that there isn't really any new information being added. It's just summing up and saying, this is the process whereby Pharaoh came to own absolutely everything throughout Egypt. Notice that the land of the priests was not purchased. The priests apparently have this allotment coming from Pharaoh on a regular basis. So they are going to get food. They are going to get priority. They get food without having to buy it. And as a result, they are able to last out the famine without being destitute and being put into a position where they have to sell their land and their property. Okay, the provision that Pharaoh has made, or Joseph has made, for the people when they sell their land and sell themselves into slavery is that from now on, 20% of everything that they produce will go to Pharaoh. I don't know, I haven't paid real close to my paycheck stubs recently, but if you count all of the stuff that's siphoned out between taxes, state and federal, Social Security, workman's comp, LTD bus, whatever it is, and who knows what all else, I would guess it comes pretty close to 20%. This amount, 20%, is considered to be quite small by comparison with the other areas in the Middle East. That we know that in Babylon, for instance, in old Babylon under Hammurabi, that it was between one-third and one-half of all of that they produced had to go to the king. So what's been set up here is not exorbitant. It is quite a bit, but it's not exorbitant by comparison. And the people are very grateful. This has allowed them to survive. This has been their salvation, and they recognize that. And it's pointed out by Moses that this policy in Egypt had continued right down to his time, which would have been the time of the Exodus, a few hundred years after Joseph. All right, meantime, we see what's happening with Jacob and his family, starting in verse 27. "Now Israel lived in the land of Egypt in Goshen, and they acquired property in it and were fruitful and became very numerous. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. When the time for Israel to die drew near, he called his son Joseph and said to him, 'Please, if I have found favor in your sight, place now your hand under my thigh and deal with me in kindness and faithfulness. Please do not bury me in Egypt, but when I lie down with my fathers, you shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place.' And he said, I will do as you have said. And he said, swear to me. So he swore to him. Then Israel bowed in worship at the head of the bed. So while the famine is raging and while the people in Egypt are being forced to use all of their money, all of their livestock, sell their land and themselves to Pharaoh, on the outskirts of Egypt, Jacob and his family are located. They were settled there at the insistence of Joseph. And here it says, they acquired property in it and were fruitful and became very numerous. So at the same time the people of Egypt are suffering greatly, we see the descendants of Jacob able to survive this famine in good shape. Now, it's not clear why they're so well stocked with food. Apparently, the famine is affecting that area as well, because they're buying up property, and presumably they're buying the property of their neighbors, people in the surrounding area who are forced to sell it. So presumably the famine is affecting Goshen as well. Why is Jacob and his family in a position to be able to survive this so well? It's not clear. It could be allotments that are coming from Joseph, that Joseph in his position is able to make sure that they're supplied with food. That's possible. We also know that some of the brothers got job offers from Pharaoh to take care of his flocks. So it could be that they have that steady source of income. And we don't know what else it might be, but in any case, they're in a position where they are able to survive very well and buy land at depressed prices. I'm sure the land is selling cheap. So they are acquiring property, and they are very fruitful and became very numerous. Jacob has reached the age of 147 years. So he lived an additional 17 years after they came down into Egypt. So now we're talking about a time well after the famine. The famine just lasted another 5 years. So now when we're talking about Jacob reaching the end of his life, this is another 12 years after the famine has ended. And he calls to his son Joseph. Presumably Joseph is still living in Egypt proper and carrying out his duties there. Jacob calls him out to Goshen. And he has a request. And his request is, he realizes he's coming to the end of his life. And his request is, please bury me in Canaan. And I suspect there are a couple of things happening here. Jacob has seen quite a bit of Egypt at this point. He knows what Egypt is like. And he knows that Egypt is not his home. That the culture of Egypt, just as I think Joseph saw, the culture of Egypt is perverse. To one extent or another, it's perverse. It's not home. That Joseph and Jacob and his descendants, they are just sojourning in Egypt. They are just passing through. That's not their home. Their home is the place that God had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That is back in Canaan. So Jacob says, promise me, son, that when I die, you'll take my body and bury it back home, back in Canaan. And Joseph promises that he will do that. Then the last sentence of this chapter, it says, then Israel bowed, and then in worship is in my translation, but that's been added by the translator. Then Israel bowed at the head of the bed. It's not clear to me what's going on there. I mean, it could be that he is worshiping, that is, that he's thankful to God for all that God has done and all the provision that God has given to him. But it does strike me that, as curious, that in Joseph's two dreams before he was sold into slavery by his brothers, in the second one, in the second of the dreams, it is both the brothers and his father and his mother that bow down to Joseph. And there is no indication previous to this in the text that Jacob ever bowed down to Joseph. So I'm wondering if that might be what is happening here. But I don't know. All right, there are a couple of issues that I'd like to talk about. The first one is one that bothers me but probably ought not. And that is, I don't like Joseph's agrarian policy here. We have a situation in which Joseph is contributing to the centralization of state power. That is, everyone is coming under the direct control of the Pharaoh. All their land, all their money, all their property, and they are enslaved to Pharaoh. And it's hard for me to see that as a good thing. Now, I realize that part of that is my modern prejudice. I have to keep reminding myself that centralized power is not inherently evil. In fact, in the new heavens and the new earth, there will be, in a sense, centralized power, that there will be a king. So I think it is probably not good to have a knee-jerk reaction to what Joseph is doing here and just assume that it is bad. So let me talk about this a little bit, and we can all think this through, and in the questions and comments, you guys can contribute as well. What were the results of Joseph's policies? Well, it did, in fact, greatly increase Pharaoh's power. He comes to own everything. He owns all the land. He has greatly increased his money, not only from the resources in Egypt, but also from the resources in Canaan. He's siphoned money in from that country as well, from that area. He owns all the land, he owns everybody, and is getting annually 20% of everything that they produce. So there's no question but what the stage has been set for despotism. That you can have a humane pharaoh in charge right now, but who knows whether the next pharaoh will be humane. And if you get the right, or I guess you should say the wrong person in that position, he has such leverage over everyone that his despotical potential would be huge. And that must have been apparent to Joseph. Joseph must have known that. It is inconceivable that Joseph would not have known that. And it seems to me that he could have done it differently. You know, in the early time, in the 7 years of plenty, Joseph was buying the food from them. But he had to have been buying the food from them at depressed prices because the production was so high, driving the price down. So he's buying cheap, and then he's selling during the famine. Well, then you can get really high prices. So he's buying low and selling high. A phenomenal deal for Pharaoh. It could have been done differently, it seems to me. It could have been that they would take the food in and they would keep track of how much each farmer put in, take some percentage for the cost of storage and that sort of thing, but then return it back to them when there's need. Because presumably enough grain was produced to get all of Egypt through the 7 years of famine. Or something like that, that was less opportunistic. That's the way I would see it. Furthermore, we'll notice that when Israel becomes a nation, some of the very things that Joseph implements are condemned. Let me read you a section from 1 Samuel 8, in which, if you'll recall, this is the time following the period of the judges, when the people of Israel were clamoring for a king. They were going to God and they said, we've got to have a king. Things are out of control. We need leadership. We need direction. We need a heavy hand to come in and give order. Besides, all the other countries have one. So 1 Samuel 8, starting with verse 10, is Samuel's warning to the people that if they have a king, this is what will happen. So Samuel spoke all the words of the Lord to the people who had asked of him a king. And he said, "This will be the procedure of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and place them for himself in his chariots and among his horsemen, and they will run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and of fifties, and some to do his plowing and to reap his harvest and to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. And he will also take your daughters for perfumers and cooks and bakers. And he will take the best of your fields and your vineyards and your olive groves and give them to his servants. And he will take a tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants. He will also take your male servants and your female servants and your best young men and your donkeys and use them for his work. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his servants. Then you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves. But the Lord will not answer you in that day." So Samuel is saying, if you have a king, you will be in the same position. He will implement many of the same policies that Joseph implemented during the time of famine, and saying, you don't want that. Furthermore, when Israel becomes a country, God establishes the order by which they will organize themselves. And Bruce Waltke summarizes their land policy this way. "In Israel, the Lord gave each family a portion of the promised land and forbade anyone, including the king, from taking it." So it seems to me that in the tradition of Israel, the very things that Joseph implemented are either condemned or precluded as something that's outside the bounds of what the king can do. However, it seems to me there's no indication in the text in Genesis that Joseph is being condemned for what he's done. The narrative clearly emphasizes Joseph's faithful service to Pharaoh. He did a good job. Joseph was acting in his boss's interest, and he made Pharaoh wealthy and powerful, the very thing that he was hired to do. Furthermore, Joseph is acting within the framework of Egyptian culture. In principle, Pharaoh had always owned everything. This is a quote from Naum Sarna with respect to the policies in Egypt at this time. "The Egyptian theory of government gave the pharaoh the supreme right of ownership of the land by virtue of his divine status. In practice, private landed property existed in all periods of Egyptian history. But after the expulsion of the Hyksos in the middle of the 16th century BCE, the major part of the land became the actual property of the state." So there's a sense in which Joseph is just putting into practice what in principle had always been true in Egypt. Furthermore, he's working within the framework of Egyptian culture in that the priests aren't exempt from this. The priests are giving allotments that allow them to go without selling their land. So he's abiding by Egyptian culture and principles. Furthermore, this was done in a way that was humane. The percentage that is taken is relatively small by comparison. The people are genuinely grateful and see this as a salvation that has been provided to them. It is the case that Joseph helped Egypt to escape a potential national disaster that would have been much more calamitous than the people having to sell their land and themselves into slavery. So Joseph was the instrument whereby both Egypt and Jacob and his family were saved. So I think there's no indication in Genesis that Joseph is being condemned in any way for what he's done. He is only being commended. He did set up a situation that has the potential for abuse. I think that's clearly true. But three considerations. Joseph did nothing that is immoral. In the policies that he implemented, it doesn't appear to me that there's anything that is immoral. Secondly, he may not have had any option. It may be that because he had to satisfy Pharaoh, that he's only working with a narrow range of options that are even possible from that perspective, or potentially possible culturally, that some may have been culturally unpalatable. And if that's the case, it could very well be that he is doing the best that he could under the circumstances. And thirdly, there is no socio-political system that is not abusable. Something that's become abundantly clear to me is that as much as I have respect for democracy, democracy is open to huge abuses, and as many would argue, greater abuses than even in a monarchy. So centralized power is not inherently evil, and in the hands of the right person, it actually works very, very well. And Joseph may be thinking, the Pharaoh in power and the ones who I see coming down the pike are all relatively humane. And so from his perspective, this is as good as can be done. So I think it's important for us to go easy on Joseph here. And I think the narrator wants us to see what Joseph has done as being a positive thing. He has actually brought about salvation for the area and averted national disaster. This passage is important for another reason, though, and I think this is the main reason why it's included here. Pharaoh is the one who benefits enormously from what Joseph has done. And yet, at the beginning of the next book in Exodus, it's Pharaoh that will not let the people of Israel go. That the lack of gratitude is extremely pronounced because of the juxtaposition of these two, the ending of Genesis and the beginning of Exodus. And I think that that is primarily what we're supposed to notice. All right, now some comments on the Joseph narrative as a whole. I've been thinking about this as we've been proceeding through these last few chapters, the Joseph narrative, and it could be that what I'm going to say I've already said, but let me try to pull this together a little bit anyway. It's interesting that Joseph becomes a godlike figure with respect to his brothers. In the narrative, it's as if Joseph is in the place of God. Why? Because, for one thing, he is almost all-powerful. And secondly, Joseph knows things that his brothers don't know. Joseph knows the whole picture. And in that sense, he's almost omniscient. Whereas his brothers only know a part of the picture. And in that disparity of power and knowledge, Joseph chooses to use the situation, and I'm convinced he chooses to use it for the benefit of his brothers. That Joseph has realized how much he learned from the injustices done to him. And he realizes that his brothers need to come to terms with what they had done to Joseph. And he sets up a situation in which they are victims of a gross injustice or gross injustices in order to help them to come to terms with their past. So what he is doing to them is actually a good thing. It's something that's in their best interests. They can't see it that way. As they come each time to appear before the vizier, it looks like he is a cruel and capricious fellow. But sometimes he's nice to him, sometimes he's nasty to him. And they can't figure out what's going on, but they know it's not good. But there are interspersed in it these acts of mercy that Joseph has put in. He can't seem to hold himself back. That he wants to put them through this injustice, but at the same time, he genuinely cares about them. And there are things that he does that are very merciful along the way. For instance, putting the money in the sacks. The money that they paid for the grain, he has put back in their sacks. And that money really plays no part in his scheme. He's just being very generous. So what, from the brother's perspective, what looks like a strange cruelty is actually something that's being done for their good. And it's only at the very end that they're able to gain that perspective and see that that's indeed what's going on. That all of these injustices have been to their benefit. It's only when they get the bigger perspective that they can see that, the perspective that Joseph has. Now, I think that that's important for Moses to include in Genesis, because what he's charting out here is the emergence of a people that is special to God, the descendants of Abraham. And in Genesis, they first emerge and God gives them the promises. But as we go on in Exodus, God is going to bring them out of Egypt and form them into a true nation. And that nation is going to go through a number of ups and downs. But even within the Pentateuch, it goes through the ups and downs. Joseph and Jacob and his family are down in Egypt, and things are good right here at the end of Genesis. But they are going to suffer between Genesis and Exodus. They are going to suffer greatly, and we see some of the suffering in Exodus. And Moses, with the Joseph narrative, is helping us to understand that God is in the position, a position similar to Joseph, with respect to the nation of Israel and his people. That they are going to suffer, and they're going to suffer injustices. But God knows what he's doing, and in the midst of all of that, there are going to be indications of God's mercy and care for them all the way along. But ultimately, they have to trust God, that he knows what he's doing, and he will accomplish his purposes, and he will fulfill the promises that he has made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So I think the Joseph narrative plays a really important role in the Pentateuch as a whole, showing us that God is dealing with his people all the way through. It may not look like, at every point, it may not look as though it's a loving God who's dealing with his people, but in fact it is, and we have to trust him for that. And it seems to me that that principle of God working with his chosen people is also at work at an individual level of God dealing with those who he has chosen out to be his, to be responsive to him, to be his elect. That on the individual level, it is also true that we experience much pain and suffering and even injustice. But God knows what he's doing. And all along, if we are attentive, we can see those little acts of kindness and mercy that remind us that God is in control, and indeed he loves us. And God is teaching us what he wants to teach us. He is carrying out, the way I think of it, as the curriculum that he has customized for each one of us individually. And he is teaching us what he wants to teach us in the time that he wants to teach it to us. And it is important for us to keep in mind that if we could see the bigger perspective, if we knew all that he knows, all of it would make sense. And trust him that that is the case. But in the midst of it, just keep in mind that we have a limited perspective and that God loves us and he is carrying out his purposes. And he has promised that he will be faithful to us. He will not abandon us along the way. That if we are one of the elect, he will bring us to righteousness. That's his goal, that's what he's promised, and that he will carry out despite all of the difficulties along the way, the things that happen that appear as though things have gotten out of control. Okay. Comments or questions? Here?
Oh, there.
Good.
Wow. What type of religion were the priests, carrying
of Egypt?
Out? Yeah.
Of Egypt. They're polytheistic, so they have a pantheon of gods that they worship. I don't know. I'm not sure how else to answer that. Do you have a more specific question?
No, I just would find it curious to see a guy like Joseph with the type of power that he had, living in that kind of dissonance, carrying out policies that certainly would be a source of friction. The internal politics of being forced to do things just to save your own skin. I don't think altruism is ever altruism. Mm-hmm. And it seems like life is just a matter of degrees of compromise. And I'm sure he had a tremendous amount of pressure to...
Right. I think that's highly likely, that the politics were probably rather fierce. That there are all kinds of constraints that would be placed on him, and he's trying to find the best solution among those that are possible. And he's not Pharaoh. He's the number two man. But even if he'd been Pharaoh, there would be constraints on him. That's the kind of complaints that you constantly hear about kings. That there are limitations on what they can do, and those limitations are quite significant. Even though in principle they may have absolute power, in practice they never do. It never works out that way. That the politics are fierce. I mean, a king is dependent upon his subjects. If his subjects are all gone, It's a small kingdom. and every king, to one degree or another, recognizes that fact. So the king has an obligation to his subjects, and that puts constraints on what he can do. That is historically always the case. And I'm sure that Joseph has significant constraints on what he can do. And it is interesting to contemplate, how does he negotiate with this priesthood of priests who are worshiping the gods of Egypt? I'm sure that Joseph's life was a difficult one.
Yeah, in thinking about Joseph, I also think about Daniel, who lived under the Babylonian kings and served them faithfully, and maybe could have got upset that he was the head of the conjurers and astrologers and everything that we would see as evil. It's striking that the two of the most righteous portrayals of individual lives in the Old Testament were a subject to and part of heathen kingdoms, and part of what is portrayed as their righteousness was their fidelity to their bosses. it really counters the notion that the Christian's life is to get a vision of perfection and then assault whatever it is that appears in their life that does not come to that ideal of perfection. It makes me wonder how holiness Christianity evolved to note that Daniel and Joseph were two of the most righteous people portrayed in the Old Testament, and part of their righteousness was fidelity to their heathen masters. It just gives you a different perspective.
Yeah, it is very interesting to have people in that with that much power, but they don't come in as radical reformers, as Puritans, as people who are going to purify the society over which they have power. That's not what they do. That is very interesting.
I also found interesting the inquiry into what was going on in Joseph's mind while he debated on how to respond to his brothers. And there's a lot in the narrative that would lead you to believe that he kind of detached himself and was following a rational plan to confront his brothers with what they did. Being one who struggled with forgiveness in a way that, being a klutz, I know that it's common in churches that you'll have a lot of people that will not forgive you if you step on their toes. But there's a lot of things in life that will confront you with things that are unforgivable in your own individual perception. And while you're contemplating, boy, you can go back and forth. And this is really nothing but imposing my own experience on Joseph, which, we're not told what was going on in his mind while he went back and forth and set up his brothers to just stomp on him and then relented and showed grace and finally got to grace, got to show them grace. But, that could very well be what was going on with him. He saw him and he had his power, and he really wanted to stomp on him. To stomp on him, he would have been stomping on his father and his little brother who was very dear to him, it looked like. So he was pulled, violently pulled, in two directions. And it took a while until he finally made his stand. And that is where righteousness is made or broken. When you come to the point where you make your stand, it's not looking at yourself and seeing that, well, there's a pull, there's a struggle. You know, it's not looking at yourself and seeing that you are living Romans 7. It's struggling through Romans 7 and then making a stand on Romans 8.
I think there are indications in the text that Joseph struggled, that there is a bit of a tension in him actually coming to the place where he can fully forgive his brothers. But I think the text indicates that he did do so, that he came to the place where he was genuinely forgiving and was not interested in being punitive. Mm-hmm. And so what he goes on to do is not punitive, but it's educational rather than punitive. Mm-hmm. And that ability to come to the place where you can forgive injustice, that is a phenomenal gift.
Yeah.
And Joseph was gifted in that respect, that God had given him the gift to be able to forgive his brothers and forgive them fully and completely. And we'll see that again next week. But that's an enormous gift.
Just a comment and then a question. That there's the picture that we saw on the news this week of the man not so effectively shooting the attorney behind the tree. That was a very poignant picture for me because I think I recognized myself in that shooter from the incompetence at executing vengeance on up. I mean, the whole thing was a poignant picture of me, I thought, because I think I knew exactly how he felt, and probably what he lost that has driven him to that is far more important than all the trivial stuff that I feel the same way about. And what was poignant about that is how ridiculous that is, and yet I'm just a fraction of an inch from being that man, from being there. So just to highlight what you're saying is that forgiveness for injustice is an incredible act of grace that I don't have the maturity to think that I can do it right and do it gracefully and do it effectively. Question, any indication in the text of Joseph's relationship with the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob during this time? I mean, is he just immersed in the polytheism of Egypt and adds to that some acknowledgement and recognition of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Does he have any sort of ongoing, I mean, I know he's getting dreams and visions, but beyond that, any sort of service, worship, acknowledgement of?
No.
No.
That's one of the features of this narrative that a number of commentators have pointed out, and that is how secular it is. That Joseph never prays, he never offers sacrifices, he never has any, God never speaks to him. He has the dreams, but God never speaks to him. And it's on that basis, then, that Jewish tradition does not classify Joseph as one of the patriarchs. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are patriarchs, but not Joseph, because Joseph doesn't have those same kinds of, in particular, God does not speak to him directly. So that's one of the curious things about this whole section, is how secular it is in that sense. But on the other hand, obviously, God has been working in Joseph's experience to bring him to a place where he understands a lot about the God who is there. And I just assume that he can make the connection between that God who's working in his life and the God of his father, Jacob. and so I don't have any reason to think that Joseph is immersed in the Egyptian religion. In fact, I really think that Joseph is repulsed by Egyptian culture. I think that's why he insisted on his family settling outside of Egypt. He does not want them to be assimilated into the culture and have them enculturated in those values. So I think he has, although he is immersed in Egyptian culture and is the number two man in Egypt, on the one hand, on the other hand, I think he is remarkably unenculturated by the values of Egypt. And presumably he is able to make that distinction theologically, and he understands that the gods that the priests of Egypt worship are not the God that's doing and bringing about all that's happened to him.
Is it you?
I have two unrelated questions. The first one is, in the time period, I don't remember what it was, 1 year, 3 years, between when Joseph interpreted the first dreams, or the first visions, mm-hmm. and the time when he interpreted the visions, the dreams for Pharaoh. Did he have any contact to know that his dreams or that he had interpreted correctly, or did he just have confidence in himself or faith in God?
I think it's highly likely that he knew that those dreams were fulfilled. He knows that the two guys disappeared, and he probably knows what fates each of them experienced.
Okay. And then my second question is regarding forgiveness in the conversation earlier. You said he was able to fully and completely forgive his brothers. I am just curious. I'm not very old, but in my experience, forgiveness is not something that I have experienced fully and completely. It's a commitment to forgiveness and a continual coming to a decision to forgive when, again, those feelings of unforgiveness arise. And I just am curious then whether you can come to a place. It seems to me that forgiveness is a lot like one's commitment to God. You know, I don't know yet if there's a place where I know that I am fully committed, but if it's every time that decision comes up, I know I make that decision again.
Yeah. That could very well be. I mean, I think that's the way you see it in the Joseph narrative, that he's sold into slavery, then there's the injustice in which he gets thrown into prison. Then he gets out of prison and is made the vizier of Egypt, and he has two sons, and it's at that point that he names the first one Manasseh, because he says, I have forgotten. And I take him seriously there. I think that he's reached the point where he is able to put the past behind him. Then his brothers show up, and I think what we see there is his first inclination, when he realizes that he recognizes them, but they don't recognize him, is to be punitive. And he throws all of them in prison. But he spends 3 days then thinking about this. It's 3 days later that he changes the whole arrangement, and he decides to let all of them go except one. Well, that wasn't originally what he had said he was going to do. And I think what happened is, during those 3 days, he struggled once again with his forgiveness. That there's a sense in which he had forgiven his brothers, but now that he sees them right before him, those emotions come flooding back, and he has to deal with those. So he has forgiven them completely, in the sense that his forgiveness is a done deal, but over a period of time, he has to work through the emotions that are attached to that. And I think that's what you're talking about. And I don't know how long that goes on. But we'll talk about this next week, but there's a verse in the end that is so important to my thinking. And that is, Joseph says to his brothers when they're afraid that Joseph didn't really forgive him, completely, he says, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." That Joseph understands that nothing happened that was out of God's loving control. But at the same time, he acknowledges that the brothers meant to do something mean and nasty. And it's coming to terms with those two things that makes it possible for Joseph to forgive. 1 more.
Just a real quick comment. It seems that whole interplay, the interchange between the brothers and Joseph, and each time his setting them up, he brings them to a point of repentance.
Right.
And I think that's part of the dynamic that's really important to observe there.
Right, absolutely. Okay, thanks.